Marshall here. Welcome back to The Real. Happy Monday, everyone. Welcome back to the show. As I said, straightforward intros from here on out. Today's guest is a return guest to The Realignment. His name is Elbridge Colby, otherwise known as Bridge Colby. He's the co-founder and principal of the Marathon Initiative. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development from 2017 to 2018, where he led the development of the 2018 National Defense Strategy. A lot of listeners have written in asking for us to do a show on Taiwan and also asking us to bring Bridge back on, given his perspective on the issue. So this episode is all about how what's happening in Ukraine affects Taiwan and how what's happening or could happen in Taiwan affects Ukraine. We're going to hit everything from technology to how we should restructure the U.S. military to meet these threats. All these great broader topics. Bridge has done a lot of recent writing on his perspective on Europe, Asia, where we should position ourselves. So lots of great stuff. Before we get into the episode, I want to shout out the Substack. I got way too busy with these five episodes last week, so did not send out the Substack. Instead, it's actually going to go out today on a Monday where I'm going to sum up a lot of things we've been thinking about. So typically this would go out on a Thursday, but I hope you will forgive me during a period where I'm doing five episodes a week from sending things at the normal cadence. So once again, subscribe to the Substack. It's in the show notes. It will come out on Monday this afternoon, but normally will come out on Thursdays. Once again, also write in if you have any questions or topics we should cover on the show. Of course, a huge thank you to the Lincoln Network. And once again, thanks for sticking around for this series. It's been very helpful for me. I hope it's been helpful for you too. Here's the episode. Bridge Colby, welcome back to The Realignment.
Great to be with you, Marshall.
We had you on last September to talk about The Strategy of Denial, which is your broader book on the U.S.'s defense approach to Asia. But this episode, we're specifically talking about Taiwan in the wake of Russia's invasion of the country. So let's just start here. You had a great op-ed out in the Wall Street Journal articulating what could happen should Putin invade Ukraine. This is February 24th, I believe. And you specifically warned against over-concentrating U.S. forces in Europe because that could endanger Taiwan and our presence in the Asia Pacific. So now that we're, almost a month into the conflict, how is the U.S. position in Asia relative to the actual moves that the Biden administration and NATO partners made?
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, it's worrisome. I think that article, I think we were right to issue the warning because nothing in the China challenge has changed. I mean, China hasn't modified as a challenge to our interests, the reasons we talked about last time. And as we discussed, I think, we need to sort of not have just like the status quo. We need to have dramatic improvement in our position in Asia. And so what I'm trying to guard against is a kind of lessening or sort of slackening of an increase in prioritization, because if we don't do that, we're on the way to defeat in Asia. And the thing is, I mean, there have been troop deployments that themselves are not the end of the world, but are worrisome in the kind of tail they involve. But there have also been discussions of potentially more significant and lasting deployments, and also within the allocation of resources within the defense establishment. So that's more what I'm worried about. And the paradox, Marshall, I've been cautious about making this point too strongly, but I think it's becoming increasingly firm that this is the underperformance of the Russian military in Ukraine, thankfully, but it's showing not only maybe they have more problems than we had thought, perhaps we overestimated the Russian military or they, poorly executed this operation, but also it's going to take them some time to recover as a military force. So if anything, I mean, I would say we should do it under any circumstances, but it seems to me that this is less of a threat to NATO now. European NATO, by the way, is building up its military capabilities, because of the response to the invasion. So that should make it even more advisable because it's more prudent to shift to Asia, but that's not where the vibe, the politics is, which is an interesting and sort of depressing or dispiriting dichotomy, because the weight of policy is actually to double down in Europe, where if anything, if you look at kind of empirically, this should actually allow us to shift more to Asia.
So let's just go through the specifics of what you just said. So help us understand what you mean by troop deployment numbers. So for example, as you pointed out, sending 5,000 troops to Eastern European members of NATO, that is not going to shift the balance in Asia relative you're talking about. What would the numbers be? Not saying you necessarily support that 5,000 policy, but what numbers, given your concerns, would appreciably impact our ability to defend our interests in Asia?
So it's not so much the numbers per se, as it is that, you know, what we have basically is a scarcity in the sort of war-winning capabilities that would be necessary to defeat either Russia or China in even broadly concurrent timeframes, right? So think of the problem as basically being like, if we get in a war with Russia and we're going to win it, we're going to use up or tie down forces for a significant period of time, you know, potentially years, given the timeframe it can be required to build even munitions that won't be available for a China fight. So if China was thinking before, well, I'm going to have to deal with X many American munitions or Y bombers or Z submarines, now it knows it has to deal with fewer. And that makes its task easier and thus makes war more likely. I mean, I would say the sort of bottom line way to think about it is we have a sort of a long range and kind of penetrating air force that's too small. We have a too small of a submarine fleet. We have too small of a tanker fleet, you know, because you still need to fly things in the air. We have our logistics backbone is too small and insecure. We have too few reconnaissance and air and missile defense assets. And we have too many ground forces. We have too many vulnerable surface ships. We have too many expensive short-range aircraft. And that's a lot of what goes into the defense budget. So what I'm more worried about is like the troops themselves, the 82nd Airborne or the 101st Airborne, they're famous units, but they don't fight by themselves, right? It's not like you just send ground forces in. The American military, you know, my favorite example, the American ground forces have apparently not been under direct air attack since the Korean War. And that's not because of the ground forces, it's because of the Air Force and naval aviation. So that's where the scarcity is though, right? So what I'm worried about is that we essentially are thinking that we're going to fight a war in Europe and we're going to bear the brunt of it in a way that will make us very, very vulnerable in the Pacific, which is the more important theater. So my point is, look, we should still be committed to NATO, but we need to move quickly to a posture where we are more of the supporting element and where we are the kind of the sort of integrator and the globally deployed global sort of asset space, long-range aviation, really high nuclear weapons, and the Europeans assume most of the conventional burden. And I think this model is much more plausible now. I mean, the Poles are going to be spending 3%. The Germans are spending 2%. Germany and Poland are together a much bigger economy than Russia is. So this is a feasible. And by the way, the Russians are losing a ton of tanks. So if anything, it becomes more plausible.
So I want to be very specific about your position, though. So when you made reference to the vibe not going quite the right way, given what you're just describing, so it's been proven that this is not the army of the 50s, 60s, 70s on the Soviet side. The Europeans, especially given the usage of anti-tank munitions, the anti-air assets, it seems as if the problem in Europe is not the fact that there aren't 100,000 additional U.S. troops there. And your concern is that given the direction of the policy conversation seems to be, yes, Russia is more of a threat than any of us anticipated, even up until this previous year. Let's double down more. So that's your concern.
That's exactly it. I mean, I like Walter Russell Mead. He's a great guy. He's a deep thinker. But his op-eds recently, but his one in the Wall Street Journal today, is a perfect illustration where Walter is saying that Putin should be the focus of our foreign policy. And that's a complete mistake. And Walter has been saying that we should... We cannot prioritize Asia, that we need to do everything. And that's not grappling with the reality of what I call military scarcity. And you've had others like John Bolton make this point. And it's strange because, I mean, it depends on sort of what you mean by threat, right? And this gets to kind of first sort of the basic heuristics that we're looking at. The ascendant class, particularly the older cadre in foreign policy circles, are, you know, liberal sort of interventionists or neoconservatives who are kind of more aggressive liberals, basically. But they tend to look at state intent, regime type. These are the key things they look at. And by that sort of interpretive lens, maybe Vladimir Putin is the worst guy out there. Maybe he's worse than Xi Jinping. I don't know, it's kind of a race to the bottom. But I look at it, when I hear threat, I think power. power coupled with the potential for intent, that's changeable. But China's a much bigger threat. And so it's a big mistake. And I think it's to be doubling down in Europe when the situation is, we know it's bad, it's deteriorating in Asia. And so that's, but yet this dynamic is actually happening, which, you know, I understand it's sort of an emotional kind of sort of, there's a sort of moralistic and, I mean, a naturally moral reaction. But from a strategic point of view, we should be focusing on Asia. And that's what's the most, you know, moral thing to do is to make sure that you're properly prepared to deter a major war.
So here's something I'm interested in here. And this has been a degree of frustration I've had. We've tweeted, DM'd about this. It's not quite with you, but it's more of people who adopt your position oftentimes. When I've spoken to casual friends, audience members who have grown more hawkish following Putin's invasion, I've also noticed that they've explicitly become much more hawkish on Taiwan questions in ways that are productive. So can you just speak to the tension between, okay, we don't want to over-focus on Europe, but when it comes to the conversation, understanding this idea that, wow, there are threats out there that need to be countered with power, with investment, with a degree of, there's just a tie there. So I'm just curious how you resolve this thing, because basically my point is, you know, there are a couple of folks who are basically saying, like, we can't focus on Europe, even rhetorically, everything is in Asia. But once again, a lot of people do just see this idea of, I'm not motivated to protect Taiwan because you're talking about our interests, or you're talking about chips or those broader things. This idea of just, wow, autocracy is on the march and they're bullies and they're bad. Let's back the Taiwanese too. That has been an argument which has just converted so many people. So I'd just love to hear you reflect on that.
No, it's a really good point, Marshall. It's something I've been talking actually to my partner, Wes Mitchell, about. And I just actually just at lunch, I was talking to another kind of a mentor of mine about this emotion as a, I don't mean it to be a kind of patronizing comment. I would say it's a, well, actually in my book, I kind of, maybe it's a thumotic reaction. I mean, to use a sort of pretentious term, but I think it's on point. This sort of passions of, you know, of vengeance and right and justice and you know, the barbarity of what Putin is doing. So these are very, very real factors in political life and certainly international political life. The way I think about it, and somebody referred to my book as clinical, and I took that as a compliment, but like my role is in my view is to rationally and clinically assess what makes the most sense for us, because passion is a motivating force, but it's not the best guide for what we should do. And I mean, I'll take an example. Like, there's a lot of passion motivating the no-fly zone issue. And I think the no-fly zone is a terrible idea and profoundly irresponsible for people to talk about. In fact, some people, retired very senior military officers who know what it would entail, have been carried away by their passions to advocate for things that they know are significantly likely to raise the risk of a war, potentially a general war with Russia. So, you know, I'm not saying that the passions don't matter or aren't good, but passions need to be regulated by what ultimately makes sense. And I'm kind of more and more making this point now, which is like, moral posturing is immoral if it leads to bad results. And that's a lot of people are out there peacocking and posturing and beating their chests and getting in high dudgeon. And they're not internally sort of internalizing the plausible consequences, the anticipatable consequences of what they're calling for. And I think that's an immoral act because we are dealing with the potential for nuclear war. So I think the moral foreign policy is one that takes account of those reasonably anticipated consequences and adapts to those in a way that minimizes the loss of life, certainly for our own people, but also for others in a way that serves our interests. And I don't mean that in a kind of totally mercenary way, but just in a broad sense.
No, this is where the clinical compliment comes in, because actually I really just like the way you put it. I'm thinking out loud here, but passion has been good, because when I have these conversations, I had a friend who's going to be a state representative in Oregon on, who had never thought about foreign policy. And he was very much making the passion point. He was saying, look, up until this week, I was not thinking of the United States as a country that could be a force for good in the world. And this has forced me to reassess my opinion on defense spending. That is an example of passion serving as a motivator. But right, to your point, that passion should not lead you just to say, okay, then no fly zone. Okay, then 10,000 boots on the ground. The next step is to be passionate, but then say, okay, how should that guide our actual policy given these concerns? So that's incredibly useful. So let's talk about this part. What, because I want to make this clear for listeners. You are speaking about a world full of constraints on the spending side. And when we deal with these issues, especially when we haven't thought of defense in this way, from a great competition perspective, it's easy for a listener to think, okay, Bridge, look, the Army is in Europe, the Navy is in the Asia Pacific, the Marine Corps is in the Asia Pacific, the Air Force is basically split between the two, but certain forces would be more oriented towards the European/Asian spaces. And then also broadly, once again, it's not as if we're even planning an amphibious invasion of China in the first place. So can you just articulate why you can't split and specify? Once again, the Marines didn't participate in the European theater in World War II. So help people just understand like why things actually are as limited as they are under your framework.
Well, World War II is actually a good example when we were spending, I don't know, what was it, maybe a third or half of GDP, and we still had a Europe first strategy. Because we had scarcity in key systems. We didn't always follow it perfectly, but it was a strategy. And it gets back to that we don't have a military, and practically speaking, we're almost certainly not going to be able to get to a military that's perfectly optimized for what we would actually want. So like we have a very large army, and it's not to pick on the army, I mean, the army has important roles, but like we have a very large army that's most of which is located in the continental United States, which like, what is that for? I mean, defending against Mexico? Right? How is that army going to get to Europe? Right? And who's going to defend it? The Navy's going to take it to Europe. It's going to be protected by air. And then when it gets to Europe, it's going to fight with air and maybe naval, but certainly space, other kinds of capabilities. And when you think about how, and you know, we don't know how, thank God, thus far, we don't know how a major war in the contemporary context would go. But the things that are really going to matter, particularly in the decisive early phases, are precision munitions, penetrating aircraft that can deliver systems or munitions that can get through air defenses, naval vessels that can carry munitions and attack the enemy in a way that's survivable, submarines usually. So like our aircraft carriers are not that relevant. I've got these guys like kind of always in my mentions in Twitter or whatever replies. He's like, oh, you know, like aircraft carriers vulnerable to the DF-21. It's like, well, yeah, no, I know this is a well-known problem, but we have like, there are ways we can get around it, but we don't have the forces for what we would need. And that's a lot of what I'm trying to push is we should reshape our forces to be more like that, but that's not where we are. So the paradox, Marshall, is that I've been arguing for years that we should move our forces more towards that. We should move our armed forces more in that direction. And often I've been arguing it's the same people who wanted to keep like extra army capacity. And now they're saying, oh, well, no, we don't have to make any choices because we can have it, you know, and like, you can't just leave. We're never gonna leave the 82nd, 101st. The Russians, by the way, have been weakened. But like, if we were facing a prepared Russian military, without tanks, without air cover, without air defense, they would get rolled over, right? I mean, even so, we're seeing against the Ukrainians. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that in a war against NATO, the Russians would behave the same way. We never know, but we shouldn't plan on it. So the reality is that we, in theory, we could have a military like that, but it's not what we get. And even if we decide to get there, it's going to take a lot of time and money. And our defense industrial base is not where we need to go. And then fundamentally, China is an economy that's as large as we are, and its defense burden is almost certainly lower than it is for us. You know, they get more value. So, and they continue to skyrocket. So we're just not, you know, and my argument is not that we should abandon Europe. My argument is that we should take a more supporting role, kind of convening role, high value add role, and let the Europeans, which was the original model of NATO, let the Europeans bear the burden, main burden of the conventional defense, which is totally fair. And now I think it's much more practical at this point.
I think what's interesting, and this is the tension, especially from people who I think would have expected to see themselves as critics of Biden, it seems as if the policy that we're pursuing as it stands right now on March 18th is basically that policy, providing intelligence support. We're not deploying troops. We're sending munitions in ways that we very rapidly can send munitions in terms of Congress actually passing funds. So let's focus then on the Asia side of things a little more. What, once again, no one knows what the Chinese are thinking on a couple of different levels this deep into the conflict. But just from your perception, how do we think, not even just citing yourself or just anyone, how do we think the Chinese are interpreting the results of the conflict, and how is or is that not affecting what we could see happening in Taiwan?
So I think it's a mixed and dynamic picture. I think there's probably too much thinking that the Chinese are going to take this as a reason for inaction. I think there are. I think on one side, you have the Chinese will almost certainly be saying complex military operations may be tougher to pull off than we originally anticipated. Now, it appears that the Russians did not actually follow their own stated doctrine against a kind of conventional force. So that is a kind of an asterisk there. But I think if you're on the Central Military Commission in China and the People's Liberation Army brings you a fancy PowerPoint of their plan, you're going to take a number of more cycles through that before you're ready to sign off. I also think the Chinese must have been surprised by the international. I'm sure they've been surprised by the difficulty the Russians have faced in Ukraine itself. But then I also think they've probably been surprised by the cohesion and strength of the international, particularly European reaction to the invasion. So those are reasons for sort of caution and conservatism on the part of Beijing. On the other hand, there are a couple of things. One is that the situation in that China faces is different from a military perspective than the situation in Ukraine. So Ukraine is about a quarter the size of Russia, you know, in terms of population. It's the second largest country in Europe. Ukraine is very easy to get into from a Russian point of view. It's a neighboring country, but it's very difficult to consolidate control. It's very large, and Russia has a relatively small army compared to the size of the task. Also, Ukraine directly borders NATO allies or NATO, you know, NATO states, so it's easily resupplied. So Taiwan, on the other hand, Taiwan's a country of 23 million people. China's 1.4 billion people. It's a high bar to entry, 100 miles of water. But once you're there, they could probably saturate it. I think it's unlikely that an ongoing insurgency would be very viable in the Taiwan case. Also because resupplying Taiwan would be very difficult because we would also be coming over water from hundreds of miles away. So military situation is different. Also, the sanctions picture is different. You know, China's 10x the size of the Russian economy, much more integrated, much more sophisticated. Its share is growing. So that suggests to me that and the fact that the Europeans in particular are taking such a hit for the Russia issue doesn't mean that they're more likely to do something else. It perhaps makes them less likely because they've already taken on a big economic burden, right? So, I mean, and we're probably going to enter into a global recession. So, I mean, countries are going to be hurting. I would say those are the big, so if I'm thinking like, so, and then the other factor is how distracted is the United States? I think that's the biggest factor. Because again, to me, at the risk of to hammer everything as a nail, I think this shows the value of denial. Putin was not deterred by sanctions. He has not been coerced into exiting Ukraine by sanctions. What's blunting his offensive is conventional denial by the Ukrainians, not by us. I mean, by the valiant efforts of the Ukrainians, but that shows that that's a very powerful force. If the United States gets pulled away, and what I would say here, Marshall, is it's not the 82nd Airborne, which you can move in and out fairly quickly. It's the potential for either forces actually being employed or being withheld and not being available. Those key forces I keep mentioning, satellites, bombers, submarines, air defense, tankers, logistics aircraft and ships, combat logistics fleet. Those are the kinds of things where if the Chinese perceive that they are tied down or inaccessible in a timely fashion for a Taiwan fight, that's going to raise their, rationally, it will raise their assessment of the allure of doing something.
Yeah, and something I also want to stress to build on your point is part of what's driving the aggressive European response is the legitimate fear that they could actively be next. There have been these amazing Twitter accounts just cataloging battlefield casualties and impacts, and they literally found a MI-24, some type of Russian helicopter that, as a joke, had "Next Stop Berlin" in Russian on it. Now obviously that's not literal, it's propaganda, but once again, that's still in the back of everyone's mind. Obviously, if you're Germany, you're not, even if you're going to face an argument around sanctioning China, no one thinks that she is going to march on Berlin.
Well, Chancellor Scholz, in his speech, he basically said the reason they're increasing defense spending is the fear of the threat. So, I mean, to me, again, this is a vindication or validation of the way I'm looking at the world. Contra Tony Blinken, this is not a vindication of the rules-based international order. Who's defending Ukraine? It's patriotic, nationalistic Ukrainians defending hearth and home, dying in large numbers. It's not the Woodrow Wilson International Brigade, you know, of Ernest Hemingway volunteering. There are volunteers, but they're not making a material difference in the battle. This is regular Ukrainians fighting for their homes. So, I mean, which was contra Fukuyama's point the other day, which was like, what planet are you living on? And then the balancing reaction, I mean, we tend to overhear Europe, given, you know, we both live in Washington, and just our elite is located on the East, political elite is located on the East Coast. We tend to overhear that, but it's not so loud. I mean, if you look, the Indians are continuing to buy oil from the Russians, the Saudis, you know, reached out to the Chinese, refused to condemn. I mean, we know all the familiar points, but I think we're sort of over-interpreting some of this. And what's happening is a little, the countries that are increasing defense spending are the ones that feel threatened. Romania, Poland, of course, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, probably, you know, I mean, okay, that makes sense, right? I mean, that's fine, but we should not be thinking that this is the, you know, the three musketeers getting together and now we're going to ride off into the sunset and defend Taiwan together too. That's not how this is going to work.
Let's speak about the allied picture. Now, what's actually, it's funny, we've talked about Taiwan so much in these various episodes, but we've never been explicit. What is our relationship to Taiwan at a defense level? Because once again, I think part of the reason why we were able to calibrate what I interpret as the proper response to Ukraine is it's very unambiguous. They are directionally a Western European country, but they're not a NATO member. They're this type of regime that then calibrates. But with Taiwan, it's so ambiguous. So A, what actually is our relationship with them?
Well, I mean, I think in practice, while we continue to have the formal policy of strategic ambiguity, from a defense planning point of view, we are planning to defend Taiwan.
And sorry, could you explain what strategic ambiguity is?
Strategic ambiguity is what's called the declaratory policy. It's the public policy of the United States government that we are have been ambiguous about how we would respond to a Chinese attack on Taiwan. Now, that is different than our political relationship with Taiwan. So we don't recognize Taiwan as an independent state. We don't recognize the government on Taiwan as a state at all. Our formal political position on Taiwan is that it's an unresolved issue. So the United States has something called the One China policy, which is basically there is one China, okay? But whether Taiwan is a part of that or how it's politically disposed, we don't take a position on. That's different than China's One China principle, which says that Taiwan is part of China. We sort of acknowledge their position, but we don't, that's not our position. So but that's different under things like the Taiwan Relations Act, which was passed when we split relations from Taipei to Beijing in the late 1970s. We say that we are opposed to the use of military force to resolve the issue of Taiwan. For many years, that was academic because the PRC didn't have the ability to do something about it. So that was the kind of the genius of strategic ambiguity was like, there was not a real problem because the Chinese couldn't do it. So we didn't really need to worry about it, but now they can. And so I think where things have ended up, and I actually think this is a pretty good place, is that the Chinese understand that we would be very likely to come to Taiwan's defense, but we don't like stick them in the eye about it. The problem is there are a lot of hindrances to interaction with Taiwan. So we sell them weapons, but we don't have a formal military presence on the island. We don't do a lot of big scale exercises with them. So this is kind of in flux now. And I mean, a lot of it's a question of trade-off of how much we want to provoke the Chinese and how much is it worth at any given time. But I think that's sort of where things are stand right now.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of things I want to get to on the attack front. So firstly, it seems as if a key part of, I don't want to say success because the Ukrainians are still fighting, but a key part in preventing the Russians from accomplishing their military objectives up front. And then frankly, it seems as if their long-term political objectives have certainly been just ruined here, has been the fact that we can directly fund the Ukrainians with specific weapons. So the Stingers in terms of anti-air capacity, and then the Javelins in terms of the anti-tank capacity really being used incredibly effectively. When you talk about arming the Taiwanese, what is the equivalent of the Javelin or the Stinger, given the nature of what an invasion could actually look like, which I'd also love for you to sort of explain what our current thinking is, what an invasion would look like.
Well, my view is that China's best course of action, actually, I think they will learn from Russia's experiment or experience, is don't screw around. If you're going to start it, you go in and you go big and you don't leave anything to chance. So what the Russians appear to have done is they practiced as a military decisive operations, kind of shock and awe. You take down the Ukrainian military and then you impose your political will. But instead, probably from Putin, and maybe it's a function of his intelligence officer kind of mindset, that they decided to kind of go for this very clean sort of decapitation, and the resistance would fall apart and everything would be hunky dory. And that's obviously not only did that fail, but they didn't fail gracefully to whatever backup plan they might have had. It also seems like Russian forces didn't know what was going on. So I think, to me, if I'm the Chinese, I take from this, well, if I'm going to do this, I don't leave anything to chance. I completely saturate and bring down the enemy military early before they have a chance to get ready and so forth. So, I mean, in that sense, my view has always been is that China's, if you want to take Vienna, as Napoleon said, is an invasion. It's a fait accompli. You basically mount a large scale invasion before the United States in particular can mobilize sufficiently. You get across the strait, you bring sufficient force, you sustain it, and then you kind of seize and hold Taiwan. And then you present the United States with a very difficult problem. And then arming the Taiwanese is absolutely critical. And the key things here are, because it's a maritime environment, coastal defense, cruise missiles, sea mines, things to slow down and complicate, and of course, just damage or destroy China's amphibious operations, but also anti-air systems, air defense capabilities, stingers and other forms of manpads would certainly be relevant. But the difference here is that I don't think there's really much plausibility that the Taiwanese would be able to fight on their own. In fact, I think that would be hopeless. I think the Chinese would overwhelm them. So it is going to be about our engagement, but we're going to have to work together with the Taiwanese in a sort of positive sum way. So they can't win on their own, but of course, if they fight hard, it's going to make it easier for us. We're going to be more successful. So that's, I think, the goal.
We're doing the episode that's coming out on Tuesday, right after this one, is about the intelligence community and everyone. Now, the intelligence after the actual invasion, in terms of falling within 3 to 4 days, like, that wasn't accurate, obviously, but the pre-invasion intelligence played a huge role in galvanizing a lot of the response, then frankly played a role in discombobulating Putin's actual ability to get that fait accompli, as you put it out there. To what degree would it be possible for us to have genuine intelligence about a Taiwanese invasion? Would you be able to see with independent looks like, oh, they're amassing troop ships, or hey, like, they've moved their aircraft carrier to this part of the strait? They wouldn't do that unless, to what degree will the picture be quiet versus not?
I think the thing about an amphibious operation like this is it's going to be very difficult to conceal. So they would probably try to do something in plain sight that we wouldn't have sufficient confidence was actually an invasion to get ready enough. So, to some extent, this is what happened in Ukraine. I mean, in the sense that, we didn't take such dramatic action that it deterred the event itself. But the other example would be 1973. The Arabs actually kind of dulled the Israelis and our sort of sensibilities for an invasion by repeatedly doing exercises and that sort of thing that led us to a kind of cry wolf problem. And I think that's probably a lot of what they're doing in their sort of air provocations over the Taiwan Strait. They're trying to dull our senses so that we're not sure what it actually is, because they do exercises a lot with amphibious operations. So are we sure each time that it's so different, or if it's a little bit bigger, are we sure it's not just a bigger exercise? That's, I think, so I would be surprised if we have unambiguous, significant lead time warning. And the other thing is it could take some time for us to get in a position where we're really ready. So as long as their timeline is shorter than ours, it's okay. They don't have to have perfect surprise like Pearl Harbor kind of situation. They just have to have enough surprise that they're ahead of our timeline.
And the key thing here, and this is what's so tricky about the Taiwan situation in terms of strategic ambiguity, what lessons of deterrence have we taken from Ukraine? Because the problem is, I could just up front as a non-expert say, okay, so the answer, part of the problem with Russia and Putin was the Russians had no idea that A, the West would be as galvanized as they were, that B, you would really see a all-encompassing public sector, private sector, NGO, I completely support this aggressive step, by the way, but they did not know the consequences would be this severe. So I could say, without knowing deeper context, okay, the answer here then is we should make clear to the Chinese that there is that level of deterrence in the Taiwan case. But that could actually provoke the Chinese to actually move quicker, because that would be a provocation in of itself in a way that it wouldn't have been with Ukraine. So how do you think about this dilemma here?
Well, one of the reasons that I'm so focused on China is I think that that approach is going to have a lot less efficacy than, and I'm not as, I don't find it as credible as I do in the Russia context. How many American companies or individuals have significant exposure to the Russian market? It's pretty small. I mean, the amount of trade, I think, between Russia and the United States is very small. The amount of economic exposure we have to China is enormous. I mean, you know, think about, like, Wall Street doesn't care if we're out of Russia, but Wall Street would care a lot if we're out of China. And, you know, we are, I mean, you know this better than I, but I mean, my sense is we're at the, probably on the precipice of a global recession. So it's gonna put greater pressure on you know, our willingness to do these kinds of things. And so, you know, to me, the idea that we would, this kind of economic outrage and sort of other things would be sufficient to deter, let alone defeat the Chinese, I don't buy it, because I don't think it would be there as much. And the Chinese are so much stronger, so they would be able to endure it. So I think, again, it comes back to military denial. We shouldn't, I don't want us to get sort of false hope about, you know, the fact that we would stop buying, you know, stop using TikTok or something will change China's calculus about a Taiwan scenario. I think we've really got to focus on the military piece to get it right.
Because the key issue to me, and this is, once again, I'm someone who personally believes it's important that we mix the Russian and Chinese threats from a pure soft power and, like we said, passion motivator perspective. But this is where this diverges as an analytical framework. The point of Russia is that Russia actually is just a weak economy. It's a military that is far weaker than we could even predict. Even before this invasion, the situation was just not at all similar. Right. And the Chinese, it's just in such a different category. Right. Okay, but wait, what's
literally
push back
an order of magnitude. I mean,
what's put back though on my, and I think your assumptions though, no one assumed that the Russian military was so incompetent that their rubber tires were rotting. You know, a listener wrote in, he was like, "Look, I'm a farmer in Missouri," and he's not a farmer now. He grew up on a farm in Missouri. I know that every summer you take out the tractor so it doesn't rot. So is it possible that we are in any way, how could we be overestimating the competence? Because also you know this too, anytime you talk about, it sounds woke to say this, but like the conversation around China gets super orientalist very, very, very quickly. Lots of, they plan in centuries, we do in minutes.
God,
like every other, like NPR, US is like kind of racist. It's one thing I'm like,
I hate that.
Woke
it's
on.
The gong, somebody calls it the gong show. You know, that whole happening. Centuries thing is like, there's the famous story where Kissinger was talking to Zhou Enlai. And Kissinger asked him about the French Revolution and whether it was successful or not. And he said, Zhou Enlai said, well, it's too soon to tell. And Kissinger for years would tell it as a story of Zhou Enlai, how they think it in centuries. And actually turns out that what Zhou Enlai was talking about were the huge riots in the streets in 1968, just a couple of years before, right? So it was just like Kissinger was like adopting this whole frame of, you know, it's like, you know, candle, Joss and that kind of thing. But yeah, no, I totally. I mean, so I guess your question, though, is what might we be overestimating of the Chinese? I think we might be certainly overestimating their technical capability of their systems, that maybe they won't work as well as people think, that maybe they're, you know, for complex joint operations, they might be less capable than they look on paper, for sure, that their economy might be less resilient and more dependent on the international system, on the dollar and so forth, on US treasuries than maybe somebody like me appreciates. That all said, I think there's a 180 degree different tendency, which, I mean, maybe in some sense is kind of an orientation, because patronizing is probably what I would say, but it's sort of the tendency to say, well, I mean, there's often an implicit assumption. I mean, to me, it's like, okay, the Chinese economy is 10 times the size of the Russian economy. They spend a lot more on their military. They're breaking out and they're number one in lots of technology capabilities. So why exactly do we think they're less of a threat than Russia? Like, I mean, I'm speaking of woke. Okay, I haven't really said this publicly, but it does like kind of annoy me as I'm a conservative. Like, I hate all this, you know, the racialized stuff and all this woke stuff and like identity stuff. But it's like, well, they're people. The numbers say this, you know, for like millennia, they were the most advanced civilization in the world, or I don't know, up there. Why do we think Europe is more important? Like, what? Like, I mean, my family's from European background. It's not about like my personal predilections, but like, I don't know. I'm just saying these are the facts. I mean, anybody who's been to China, or let alone the other Asian tigers, it's very impressive. So I kind of think to myself, well, and people say, well, the Chinese haven't trained for complex joint operations. It's like, well, I'm okay, but I mean, you know, could they figure it out? Like, you know, well,
you actually just got to my next question, which is, well, I mean, look, like the last time the Chinese fought a war is an unsuccessful invasion of Vietnam in 1979. Yeah. Respond to that, right? Because this is just what people say, right? Like, what's the
sure? Point? I mean, true. The last time the United States fought a great power war was World War II. The last time U.S. forces were under direct attack was in Korea, and we've been focused on the Middle East in a way that may not be that good for our preparation. So I'd kind of complicate that narrative. Look, I think we certainly have the advantage in terms of the quality and training of our forces, partially because the stuff that we'd worked on in the Pentagon, we're focused more on great power conflict, preparing for going back to the basics. So I'm sure we're more ready and better at it in general than the Chinese. But the question is, like, how much of a premium does that buy? You know, as Stalin said, quantity has a quality all its own. Well, the Wehrmacht in World War II was pound for pound, almost certainly by far the best military out there, but it got overwhelmed, you know, and the Chinese are building, you know, missiles and ships and aircraft and satellites way beyond what we anticipated or most kind of public source observers anticipated. So that tells me, you know, okay, if we give ourselves, let's say we give ourselves like a 10% advantage. Well, if they get a 50% quantity advantage, it's going to be overwhelmed. And so I just don't take a lot of, you know, and a lot of our concepts of operations haven't really been tested that well either. Like, how would our, you know, we haven't had a fleet to fleet conflict since World War II. Now, our Navy is undoubtedly the best in the world, but, you know, is the aircraft carrier exactly what we would need for dealing with the, you know, Chinese forces that can shoot missiles accurately out to 1,000 miles or whatever? Probably not. Doesn't mean you get rid of it, but you certainly think about your naval force structure differently and how you train people. So I sort of think of that as like, okay, we have an advantage, but we shouldn't overthink it. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, I like to use like the football example. It's like you won the Super Bowl last year. You've got linemen who are all, you know, 230, and they're really good. They're really experienced. This other team that's practicing has linemen who are like 300 and are in incredible shape. And like, yeah, they haven't played as a team as much together, but like, they're pretty big. So you should take them seriously.
And this is getting to another, I mean this seriously, you're helping train me against overgeneralizing from the Ukraine conflict, but something that folks have just really noted is this Ukraine conflict looks very 1980s. T-72s, T-80s, Su-25s, Su-34s. We're talking about MiG-29s from, like, that isn't happening, but MiG-29s. But once again, very like fourth generation warfare style conflict things. Like, yeah, the Russians aren't using the Su-57s. I forget the name of like the new big tank, which isn't available in numbers to even use. As we're looking at how 1980s and 1990s this conflict looks, how does that affect our assessment of how high tech, quote unquote, a war in Taiwan would be? Because just to put a little bit on that, like, if we're thinking of fourth generation fighters, so our F-16s from the Air Force, the F-18s from the Navy and Marine Corps, these are fighters that are not stealthy. They are not expected to survive long in a fifth generation style conflict, but the Ukraine one isn't fifth generation. There's reluctance to use those style of forces. So how should we just think about this idea?
It's a great point, Marshall. I mean, a really nuanced and sophisticated point. I mean, I think actually what we're seeing, and Mike Kaufman, who's very, very smart on the Russian military, has kind of pointed out that the Russians may be withholding forces because of another scenario. And I think they're actually probably facing an example of this kind of scarcity that I'm talking about in the Europe-Taiwan context, which is they can't so denude themselves of high-end equipment that they leave themselves vulnerable to NATO. Because, okay, like, we're not interested in invading Russia, but, you know, the Russians are paranoid, and you know they have a history, and we're not going to change that. And their military planning is going to be conservative. So my sense is that they are probably withholding significant advanced capabilities, both because of like numbers, but also they might not want to expose, you know, tactics and concepts of operations and technologies that would make them more vulnerable to us. And that to me is like a big lesson, is that, you know, you're fighting kind of, I mean, they put a lot of their ground forces in, but in terms of like missiles, air, they haven't been using their air that much relative to, or I'm not sure exactly how true that is, but like, that's a big lesson for me. And I mean, I think it's an interesting point about the fourth generation thing. I mean, I don't know what it says. I mean, they didn't do the big barrage early on that you would expect certainly the Chinese to do. And that seems to have hurt them. So, I mean, the lesson that I would take from this, if I were China, is just don't mess around. Like, don't leave anything to chance and don't have these fancy plans. I mean, this has always been my view of the Taiwan thing. It's like, I don't think it's smart for them to think they could do some fancy assassination decapitation thing, because eventually the victory mechanism is going to be the same. And if you don't get the victory mechanism right, you're going to run into what the Russians, fortunately for us, have run into.
Yeah. And I'm also realizing the other problem with the framework I just provided is this was not the war the Russians were planning on launching. So once again, the key thing is the test isn't why didn't they use their Su-57s? Because if they'd known this was going to take a month, that's a whole different style of conflict.
Right.
And that is actually, and I could actually, once again, as a non-betting man and a non-military expert here, I would bet a world where they have to think, how do we convince NATO to not stick in for this for a month, is a world where they do try to utilize much more technological dominance than when they're dropping in unassisted paratroopers to get slaughtered in airfields.
Right.
I just did an episode of a Stanford professor on this. Mm-hmm. He basically said his problem with Russian strategy on the military side is it's always just too cute. Everything is just always and this is the point you're making.
Which was not their traditional strategy. I think that strikes me as, and I don't know, but I mean, that strikes me as Putin and the intelligence officer mindset, which, you know, I mean, they didn't build a military for that. And so now they're paying the price.
So here's the next question. Let's get to, once again, a critical feature that we seem to have over the Russians and the Chinese is the fact that we just have a bigger legitimate alliance here. So once again, India and Saudi Arabia are not playing ball, but once again, they're neutral powers. Mm-hmm. It's not as if there's a war where you're getting Indian brigades joining into either fight on the Russian or the Chinese side.
Right.
So we actually have, NATO, we have the ambiguity of, but also like clear aggression on the Japanese front. We have the Australians, the United Kingdom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How does the allied side of this play out? Or how play out, because I'm not asking for a prediction here. What does the allied picture look like right now in the Pacific?
Well, in the Pacific, it doesn't look so great. In Europe, it's gotten much better. I mean, I wish they had done this before Putin invaded Ukraine. It might have sent a different signal. But I mean, you know, the thing about our alliance network is that in theory, it's like an incredible resource that should allow us to be, you know, overpower any adversary. But in practice, especially since the end of the Cold War, most of our allies haven't done anything. They have like these kind of small militaries that can't really be used for anything outside of maybe direct territorial defense. And so that's led to our alliance network punching like way below its weight in terms of the military power it delivers relative to like its latent capacity. So that is now changing, fortunately, in Europe, right? So the Europeans hopefully will continue their defense spending increases. That will allow them to carry more of the defense burden in Europe, even as we continue to contribute. And then we can focus more on East Asia, where Japan really needs to step up and Taiwan needs to really step up. But, you know, we're not going to be able to do this alone, just because of China. China's this economy of the same size, and it has advantages of proximity in Asia and, you know, geographical sort of interior lines from a strategic point of view. So that's where the allied picture, I mean, my view is that we should work with our allies where our interests most align and where they have the will and the way to do something about it. So like, I think it's a terrible idea to sanction the Indians or kind of, you know, tub thump against the Indians on the Russia thing, because at the end of the day, whether the Indians vote against the Russians or not, or how much they join the sanctions, is not going to be the main driver of what's going to happen in Ukraine. But we really need them, and they need us in about the biggest challenge we face, which is China or Israel. Like, why are we giving Israel a hard time? Israel's got to deal with the Russians in the Middle East. They have relations with the Russians. Like, what Israel does on the Ukraine situation is not going to be a driving factor. And they, you know, if they pull their weight in the Middle East and are a big part of the Abraham Coalition, well, that's a much more beneficial for us. So I think that's how we, but that's very different than how the administration or certainly the president Blinken look at it.
And I've got some useful questions from our high school intern extraordinaire, Aaron Visser. Need to give him the shout outs for the prep he's doing. But basically, at this point, it seems like the more interesting question isn't whether China invades Taiwan. It's why haven't they invaded Taiwan?
Yeah.
Given all of this, given the ambiguity, I mean, I realize you serve in the Trump administration, but once again, there was an ambiguous space that could have really defined this. There's the COVID, talk about time when things would have been ambiguous. Why haven't they invaded yet?
Because I think that Taiwan is so elemental for them, and taking on the Americans or risking taking on the Americans directly is such a big step. They don't want to mess it up. You know, so I think if I'm Xi Jinping, I want 80% plus probability of success, mm-hmm. not 62%, not you know, heads or tails. And I don't think they're there yet. Sort of manifestly, I don't think they feel that they're at that, whatever that number is. Because I think that otherwise, I think that's right. I think in the next 5 years, my question is going to be more like, what are their reasons for not doing it? Because, you know, they're going to increasingly have a plausible way. They clearly have the will. And in some sense, there are good reasons for urgency, given some of the balancing dynamics that are happening against China. So I think that's actually the right way of looking at it.
And at a broader level, it seems clear, once again, we only know so much about the Russian system, but this, everything that's gone poorly in the Russian invasion seems very much on Putin, in the sense that kept this very secret. Yeah. This was not created a very at a very literal level with the long tables. People were like, these tweets and photos are so beyond parody. It's just beyond parody. So literally created the opposite of the environment you'd want to create to prevent this from basically happening. So you see the worst features of autocracy. And I think this is the part where obviously the Hitler comparisons are usually overblown, but I think this is actually where it's useful, in the sense that in systems where you have a leader who has very specific expectations, he or she can construct scenarios where you're going to incentivize bad decision-making. How does this look on the Chinese side? Because oftentimes when people articulate why China would invade in, let's say, the next 5 or 10 years, it is, well, he's getting older. This is his legacy opportunity. He wants to unify all of what he sees as China. It seems like he, on a personal level, much in the sense that Putin had the whole build the Russian Empire, I'm the new czar thing, there is also a personal aspect too. How much does the Chinese system, as I think it would be incentivized to do up until Xi, push back against the personal autocratic aspects? But how much is this, with him ending term limits, really him able to assert his will?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard to read. I tend to, and again, I mean, I don't pretend to be the world's expert on this kind of stuff. I'm trying to kind of give a framework. Obviously, I follow this stuff, particularly about the Chinese, closely. I mean, it's definitely my impression that Putin has created a highly centralized and personalized system. I mean, even up to like very, you know, mundane levels. I mean, and a very tightly controlled system. I mean, apparently I was reading earlier today that some of the reason for the delay in Russian movements of forces is that maybe waiting for higher orders, or that may be why some of their, so many of their general officers have been killed, is because that, you know, they need to go forward and actually direct themselves. So there's that strong culture. So it's kind of the opposite of, you know, the XCOM from the Cuban Missile Crisis that Kennedy had, sort of, in a lot of ways. I think, you know, I'm not always a fan of Kennedy, but I thought he handled that particular crisis quite well. And he had a lot of different views, and people were able to have a robust debate. That's not the vibe you get from these presentations that Putin is having. In terms of Xi, I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, I think, you know, he seems to have centralized a lot of power. One of the reasons, I think, there was that Hu Wei paper that was circulating, I think last weekend in particular, saying that, you know, China should completely abandon Russia and kind of, you know, reengage with the West. I mean, one where I think personal kind of role is going to be very important is like Xi Jinping. This is his central policy, is taking a more confrontational approach to the United States, a more aggressive turn in the international environment. So I think arguments that are against him in that way are going to be very difficult to anticipate. Then again, you know, I mean, Putin, you know, individuals can go cut the other direction. Deng Xiaoping was probably more accommodationist to the West and the United States than your average Chinese communist boss of the time. So, you know, and I mean, of course, autocracies have the benefit of being able to, you know, move more quickly and efficiently if they are, you know, operating in that way. So it's kind of a it's kind of a trade in that respect. But here, actually, one thing where there is the Hitler analogy might make might resonate quite well is, you know, Hitler had, against the predictions and advice of all the graybeards of the time, had said, we're going to remilitarize the Rhineland. We're going to push the Western powers around over Czechoslovakia. We're going to do the Anschluss. We're going to go to in Poland. And then the invasion of France was this transformative success for them, which they more than they expected. And then Barbarossa, you know, then he made his mistake. And,
gamble.
Yeah, Georgia, Crimea, you know, and then it's like, ha, I'm the genius. And all these minions don't know I'm the super. And then it's like, oh, whoops. And then you really mess up. So
two last questions here. Well, actually three. So first question is, let's just talk about the nuclear aspect real quick, because this has really been Putin invoking the possible use of nuclear weapons, at the, especially at the tactical level. I think especially to just your average listener, that was a real shocker, and shaped it. How should we think of nuclear weapons, especially tactical nuclear weapons, given the close quarters of this entire conflict? How should we think about that in the Taiwan context?
Well, I mean, look, the only thing that's defending us from Russian nuclear strikes is Vladimir Putin's incentive structure. So, you know, Russia's incentive structure. So this is very real, and people who dismiss it, I think, are wrong. Now, that doesn't mean you just cower and give everything away. But, you know, the key is to thread the needle and walk the line between, you know, cowering and falling over into almost giving him a pretext to escalate in a way that's advantageous to him. I mean, I think the Chinese are pursuing building a nuclear force that's more looks like what the Russians have today, which is a strong nuclear force that can have a lot of coercive leverage. Not universally, it doesn't mean that you can like get us to abandon the Baltic states, but it does mean that it puts limits. It has to put limits on what we are prepared to do. And I think in the context of Taiwan, what it means is that they'll probably use conventional forces to try to win and then use the nuclear weapons as a kind of a shield to prevent our trying to escalate our way out of defeat. That's I think, their goal.
That's your point around a key lesson could be take Taiwan and then say it's over.
Don't even go there, because like if this escalates, it's going to be much worse for you than.
Yeah, than it's and that's and that, so and then Here's what we'll wrap with. I'd just love to for you to give a very, we kind of alluded to this at the top of the episode, but just what should we do? Just outline, given everything we just discussed, right? We're in this holding pattern policy-wise, I think is the right way to put it. So we're not sending the 100,000 troops you feared, but it seems very clear that a lot of this is still being fought out in the media, fought out like in back circles. Zelensky's making his own appeals. In the Taiwan context, then, what should we do?
I think we should, you know, if I were secretary or whatever advisor, I'd say every day, how are we getting better on the Taiwan fight? Are we buying the right things? Are we buying enough in the munitions? You know, and then I would push the Taiwans really hard to buy the right things. I would offer them help to do it if they buy the right things, conditionalized aid. I would push the Japanese really hard to spend.
Sorry, what should they buy?
They should buy things like anti-ship cruise missiles, sea mines, air defense, cyber resilience, you know, man pads. Anti-tank capabilities, because some Russian Chinese forces would almost certainly be able to get on the island. You know, that kind of thing. Those are the kinds of things I would be doing. And then in Europe, I would focus on building up the Europeans and supplying the Ukrainians, but taking more of a and clearly messaging to them that we have to do this, because we can't do it all like we used to. That's not an abandonment, but that's a more realistic and sustainable model.
I actually lied. There's the actual last question I was remembering. My group chat that I'm a part of got in a big argument around what can Biden actually do without congressional authorization in the case of an invasion. Oh. So let's say that we do see that the Chinese are starting to, there's this, you know, training exercise you're describing. Well, things are starting to shift. We'll think, whoa, 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 they're shifting. Can Biden say, okay, we're sending a destroyer as a blocking action between the Taiwan and the mainland? Is that, I'm not saying that's necessarily the right military move to do, but what can Biden do given the stakes?
I don't know. You know, Elaine Luria introduced a bill, I think, that was pre-delegating. I mean, I guess I'm kind of inherently skeptical that that's necessary. I mean, presidents seem to have been able to.
This is my assumption. My assumption was you can pretty much do.
And I wouldn't spend a lot of political capital on that. I'd spend the political capital on getting prepared.
Yeah.
We'll figure out the legal thing at the time. That's sort of my take.
And if you're a person interested in limiting the power of the executive branch, that's a whole different argument. But it seems to me that if something were happening, the notion that we're getting up at 2 a.m. to get the congressional vote together seems ridiculous. Also, it would leave a very specific vulnerability. The libertarians are going to piss me for saying this, but this would leave an obvious vulnerability for the Chinese to exploit. It'd be do the blitzkrieg, go all out. And they are going to get, and by the way, every single time we take one inch closer, the less chance you get a congressional response on any of those questions.
I mean, I think we could, I don't know. I mean, if we saw that kind of thing, the president should call the Congress in, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert on this stuff, but like call the Congress in and vote for an authorization, you know, if it's for something. I mean, I don't know. On December 8th, 1941, there was a vote, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think I'm more worried about winning the war.
Okay.
You know?
We're not going to have a situation where everyone's sleeping and then it's like, oh no, we couldn't.
Well, if it's that
direct.
Quick, we're going to be screwed anyway. You know what I mean? It would probably be before and some kind of vote giving the president authorization of some kind. And then there might be another vote. I don't know.
Well, Bridge, this was excellent. Okay. So you write a lot. It's, you know, in our think tank world, it's, this is not common. So that's a huge compliment. So a shout out, shout out the book, and then shout out some of your recent writing. Some of it may have gotten a little dated. So like you had a Wall Street Journal piece in November 2021. I'm not sure if that quite would hold up to, well, not even hold up, but events happen. So please shout out the book and then any articles.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, Marshall. I mean, my Twitter feed's at Elbridge Colby. I'm there. And then also I've got all my stuff, you know, media kind of stuff on the marathoninitiative.org. But my book is The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Which, you know, is kind of how our geopolitics, but particularly our defense strategy, should adapt. And then more recently, I had a piece in Time magazine about how we should prioritize Asia, but, you know, while helping in Europe. So that's kind of, I would say, pretty timely. And then I had a piece in the journal with Oriana Mastro, I think at the beginning of February, that was basically arguing we can't afford to get distracted in Europe, which, you know, unfortunately, I think is a real risk still. So.
Great. Bridge, thank you for coming back on the show.
Great. Thanks, Marshall. Good to see you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.